Your unconscious has to be well informed, or your idea will be irrelevant.
Many aspects of life are a puzzle you need to solve, and you haven't solved it until you've solved it, and you can't impose your will on it.
But no, Steve Jobs was never CEO until he came back to Apple. Another guy observes that a decision is a prediction of what's going to happen.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Marketing and Everything Else podcast. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well. We've hit our first 80-degree day up here in Portland. It was a gorgeous one.
Oh, it is a very nice day.
My taste in May, so.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it's been unseasonably cold in the Bay Area, especially at nights.
Mm-hmm.
So as you all know, our wonderful listeners, Doug and I get together for literally hours and chat about a lot of things before we press the record button, which we now have done. But as usual, we want to start with the cartoon of the episode. So what is in the cart?
All right. So the cart, we have a meeting with four people sitting around a table. The meeting is ending. It looks like a guy at the end of the table is talking, but I'm not sure. And the guy at the end of the table says, "I know we're out of time, but I did want to quickly cast doubt on everything we discussed and nullify any progress we've made."
Excellent.
And, I have to admit, my first reaction was, as an Overthinker Anonymous member and an Overdiscusser Anonymous member, I wonder how many times I've done that, but I wouldn't confess to it.
So I had two takes on this. One was just the person in the meeting who wants to preserve the option of saying, "I told you so,"
mm-hmm.
you know, or document the fact that they were in favor of it, but they also were not in favor of it, sort mm-hmm. of a thing. Mm-hmm. But the bigger reaction was the complexity of the decisions that are being made and mm-hmm. how many times in a meeting you feel that you're obligated to come to a conclusion because the meeting is about to end and you must have made progress mm-hmm. and you haven't because it's mm-hmm. too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I really just don't know. And if the collective wisdom is that we need to decide on something because we're faced with some kind of a deadline,
mm-hmm.
then let's all agree that that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you pretend to have clarity when you don't, mm-hmm. then maybe it's a voice of reason to say, "Hang on a second, I know we made a decision, but mm-hmm. let's all remember that it wasn't with any sort of ironclad logic and evidence."
Yeah, and I liked when you brought those up in our three-hour pre-discussion. Because I think that that happens a lot. Group dynamics are such that there's a lot of groupthink. There's a lot of need for meetings to be meaningful, which means, did we arrive at decisions? I know that I probably frustrate people because I'm perfectly comfortable not having made a decision in a meeting as long as we progressed and got a much better clarity on what we're trying to deal with, especially if the decision isn't necessary. Sometimes meetings do something where we don't need a decision. We just need to develop our clarity. So I'm pretty comfortable with that. And I'm sure I've frustrated people who are more purely meeting trained with the idea that, well, there has to be a decision, you know, write it down.
Like exactly you said, do I have a deadline? Mm-hmm. So let's make that decision based on the data that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And my big rule is I want to remember the circumstances under which I made that decision. We mm-hmm. made that decision. So we all remember mm-hmm. and do not second guess ourselves in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
Say, look, let's all remember we did not have that piece of data at that time. And maybe you make the right decision and all is well.
Mm-hmm.
And the other aspect of it is like debugging a computer program.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't debugged it until you've debugged it. Mm-hmm. There is no deadline that can be enforced.
Right.
Debugging. You just don't mm-hmm. have it.
Mm-hmm.
And if your meeting is a debugging meeting,
mm-hmm.
making progress, eliminating some options or mm-hmm. removing, all that is the best you can do
mm-hmm.
until it is in fact debugged. And I mm-hmm. feel like many aspects of life are a puzzle you need to solve. And you haven't solved it until you've solved it. And you can't impose your will on it.
This is one of the places I've disliked the business school idea that managers are deciders. The idea of decisions being most important, often understanding is far more important. You know, if we can develop an understanding, if I'm working with a good team, the team figures out what they should do if we have understanding. And it's, I think it's less common that you really have to have an executive making a big set piece decision. It's interesting when I read about decision making, right? Because there's a whole set of literature about how should decisions be made. It bothers me because they're dealing with artificial situations almost all the time, right? Where they create this idealized situation. Let's talk about how a decision should be made here. Yeah, but I haven't worked in an idealized situation. There's always mess around. There's always the reality of things changing and people changing. And, you know, you never have that kind of lovely purity that is used in decision process.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah. And more so as time goes by. And of course, you know, once again, you're writing a book about this. The complexity of life keeps increasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the complexity of business keeps increasing. And you have all these expected and unexpected curveballs that come at you. So you're going to have to do your best, but it's best to remember that sometimes you don't have the data and sometimes you do, and sometimes you have to make a decision and sometimes you don't. So yeah, I think it's like that.
I was interested in your observation that it could be that this guy is the sandbagger, the guy that's kind of hanging back, not really wanting to participate because they don't want it to either be blamed or credited with the decision. You know, there's a lot of that, you know.
It's a time-honored strategy that if you predict every possible outcome, you can now say, I told you so. So in situations like that, you just need a boss that sees through that and doesn't allow it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, too many bosses allow transparent tricks like that carry on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. Well, I think some of it, you know, I mentioned to you the Bob Lutz quote of it, you know, when he was at Renault, that he had his team, and his observation was if anybody from the outside was watching his team in a meeting, they would be shocked because it looked like the team members were mutinous and staging rebellions and talking to him in ways they shouldn't. And his comment was they did very effective work because they got rid of the, I think it was something about the you know, wads of tissue paper that so dominate corporate meetings where nobody will really quite say anything because it's behind the wad of tissue paper. And he found that that team was quite effective because
Well, I think anytime you can instill a culture that allows you to discuss real stuff with real seriousness, and people have different ways of discussing things by saying tough on issues, soft on people, call a spade a spade or whatever. Mm-hmm. But one way or another, if you are able to get the best perspective out of people because they feel safe to share it. And that requires a culture where people who are attending know that they personally are not being judged. Their own value is not in question. Their own respect is not in question. And they're all trying to solve a problem together with their colleagues. If you create that, I think you're golden. And then you certainly will have animated, passionate discussions that are just very real, and they're not about building a, you know, evidence to go after someone.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I particularly like the term respect. Now, it's not that everybody should be respected for everything, but every person, if we can respect every person is trying, is doing their best, is wanting to contribute something valuable, and we respect them for their own expertise or position or whatever that is, then you get participation that you won't ever get in those kinds of situations where people are so afraid of the politics, you know, going against them. And
that's right. I think also the composition of the meeting has an important role to play because in a public meeting, you can't really expect that.
Yeah.
In a more intimate meeting, you can, if you have established a trust that as the leader of the meeting or somebody who kind of called it, you are looking for the best decision. You're not looking to use this as a way of assessing or passing judgment on people.
Well, I think too, I, you know, I've played some, and I'm not sure it's going to make it into the, you know, final version of the book, but I think there really is something around doing things that matter, because I think a lot of business time, a lot of government time, a lot of committee time, a lot of, you know, meeting time is spent on issues that aren't really very important. And, you know, when we were at Floating Point and I was at headquarters, I know you weren't there yet for these, you may not have seen this happen, but the VP of marketing we worked for, Don McDougall, he would call his people into his office and take out a blank sheet of notepaper and say, all right, what's important? And we'd talk about what was going on. And what I really took away is he didn't start from a to-do list. he started from a blank piece of paper. Mm. And I ended up deciding, I don't know if Don meant this or not, but this is what I decided, was that, you know what, if it's not top of mind anymore, it's not that important. And we build so many checklists where we feel like, oh, well, we've got to check off everything. And some things you do. If you're doing a software release, yes, there are checklist things. But in terms of sales and marketing organization, are we doing what's important right now? I like the idea of sitting back with a blank sheet of paper and talking to the key people and saying, what's important? And if it fell off the sheet last time, it probably wasn't that important. And that's generally what I found, you know. So,
all right, let's go to our next topic. And you shared a piece of news on Apple, and we wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, I wanted to do a slight correction, a course correction on what I'd said, because I observed that Sequoia Capital had tremendous influence on Steve Jobs and his marketing. And I went back and over it a bit more depth since. And it's actually a little more complicated and interesting than that, because Sequoia was certainly involved. But also, a lot of the work led to bringing a guy named Mark Markula into the company. Mike Markula. And then through all of that, Regis McKenna became involved, who was, you know, the Silicon Valley gods of PR at the time. I mean, just really phenomenal from what I read. Did you ever work with Regis McKenna?
No. He was featured at the Computer History Museum as a celebrity because he had influenced a lot of major players in Silicon Valley, including Intel in the early days.
Well, I think it's interesting because everybody talks about Steve Jobs as a marketer, but when you look at this, Mike Markula brought a tremendous amount of marketing in his first connection with Apple, although he also came in as an investor. And then Regis McKenna, tremendous power. So I think your observation last time is, you know, it's noble that Steve Jobs learned how to market, you know, that he didn't pop out of the womb as, you know, fully able marketer. He probably had the natural talents of a good marketer, but he had the good fortune as well of working with these other people. And I can only imagine how far his talents moved between, say, 1976 or 77. And
I think Steve Jobs, one of his biggest strengths was his ability to learn and to synthesize that learning into what became very effective for him and for Apple. But also Regis McKenna, the paper that he wrote for Harvard Business Review about 30 years ago continues to be really pretty valid and foretell a lot of the things that we're seeing right now. So definitely one of the greats of marketing, definitely one of the greats of B2B marketing, and was really interesting to see that he had a role to play at Apple. Mm-hmm. Now, many people don't know that Mike Markula, besides being an early investor and employee of Apple, he also served as CEO in the early days. In fact, that led us in our pre-call to go look up all the different CEOs of Apple. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who would have thunk Steve Jobs actually wasn't CEO until he became interim CEO in 1997.
Yeah.
You know,
somehow, you know, the mythology around Steve Jobs, you know, it always happens. Mythology exaggerates. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was shocked when you brought that up that Steve Jobs was never CEO until he came back to Apple after his period of exile. Interesting, too, I was looking at Mike Markula because he stayed not as CEO after his 3 or 4 year period as CEO, but he became chairman of the board and was chairman of the board for a decade, if I remember right.
Yeah, in fact, at least he was reported as saying that he was chairman of the board when Steve came back. Mm-hmm. So he obviously was in favor of the CEO at the time, Gil Amelio, who bought Steve Jobs' next company. Mm-hmm. And that was his way of gaining an operating system that they had written and also pull Steve back. And Markula was saying that he was chairman and he was about to leave, but then he couldn't leave because the timing wasn't right. Mm-hmm. So when Steve Jobs came back and became interim CEO, he actually was part of the team that essentially got rid of the old board and he left himself at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard to tell from outside, which is also just a reminder that when you hear the news from outside, especially when you're talking about boardroom sort of intrigue, there's a lot going on that people don't know.
Not all is what it seems. Yeah, in fact, Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs said that certainly in the early years, in the 70s and 80s, that Steve Jobs and Markula really connected well. And it did a lot of really good things for Apple
He was definitely very, very key in the whole history of the company, for sure. And besides also putting one of the first checks in the company as a personal investor, because he'd made a bunch of money having been at Intel when Intel was like going from strength to strength.
Yeah.
And then hanging around in the company as an employee, as a senior person, bringing other investment into the company, et cetera.
Speaking of apples, should we go buy some at a warehouse club?
Well, I think Sam has one.
See what I did there? So for our next story, let's go look at Sam's Club. And I saw this some headlines that intrigued me. And it talked about Sam's Club, which is, you know, that's Walmart's warehouse that competes with Costco, or that you can consider in the same sentence with Costco. And it's all about them beginning a grab-and-go offerings, which I saw it, and being a member of Retail Wire Brain Trust, my comment was that I was kind of underwhelmed because I wasn't sure what they were trying to achieve with it. So the big news was they're doing this grab-and-go offering. But I wanted you and I to talk, Shaheen, about, I see more and more of these top headline-grabbing announcements that when I look into the details, I end up walking away wondering why they're not pursuing something that matters, something that makes a difference, something that has big potential in it. I think partly in marketing, we're always struggling between, you have to continue to improve things. You always have to keep making sure your offerings are up to date, that you're checking out some new ways to work with them and keep everything fresh. But we have to be able to separate those that are making sure the deck chairs are clean and well-organized from the ones that have to do with whether we're going to make a bunch more money, whether the company is going to become significantly more nimble or more able to be resilient, or so forth and so on. And I think it's kind of a sense to my mind that every time I look at a headline, I'm always asking, is this a little thing or a big thing? And this one struck me as a lot of hubbub, but I'm not sure I could quite understand why.
Yeah, well, it's hard for me to tell why they did this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would probably decide everything. So it is possible that they did it because they're trying to expand their total available market. Mm-hmm. And if it is a TAM expanding move, then you could say I can envision that the justification would be something like, there are so many customers who aren't shopping at our stores because they also want to grab something to eat and we don't make that easy for them. So they just opt to go elsewhere. And you could say that, okay, there's 100,000 such shoppers around the country. An average cart is $200. So that's a $20 million like revenue that we will missing. And then I say, $20 million, it's going to cost me probably more than that to implement this. Not interested. But you could say that there's 1 million such people and they're doing $200 a cart. So now it's 200 million, you start getting warmer and it might be interesting even as a TAM expanding argument to go implement this. So it could be one. The other reason could be competitive pressure. Hey, we're competing with Costco. They seem to have a really popular food court. Our own food court is not doing as much. We have two options. We can go fix or improve our existing food court, or we can disrupt the business by having something completely different and take some kind of a competitive advantage in there and upper hand. So I can see that. I could see that it, in the competitive context, it could just be a media presence thing. We're doing something really viral and interesting, but then it's too costly for that. It's not just a marketing program. It's a novelty and maybe it'll bring, you know, that also doesn't seem convincing. Or it could be that the markets are changing, that we're seeing that the demographics are towards single people or just a family of two. They're not going to go buy 200 donuts for the next, you know, 3 months. They might just want to grab two and we will offer that. So now it's not just a grab and go, eat it on the spot. It's like, that is your shopping for the week. Well, and that and would be interesting. And that's another TAM expanding thing, in fact.
Well, and you and I were talking about, there is this challenge that as some of us become empty nest or close to empty nest, our motivation for shopping at Costco drops significantly. You know, we buy paper goods, we go to the store once, maybe twice, the warehouse once, maybe twice a year. So I can see that they've got that change coming up. I think there's one other option that I know I'm going to be a few people, listeners, you're welcome to call me a skeptic. But I will offer the one other political possibility, which is embedded in this announcement is the fact that people will be able to use a phone app for scan and go, where they just pick up the food, scan it, and go. And I have seen a great many efforts where the tech groups have a capability, and then they take an operation like Sam's Club, and they're looking at it saying, we want to do scan and go in Sam's Club. Where can we do it? And then they develop a whole rationale because they really need to get their software used within the company. So I think, I know, I'm a skeptic. Yes. You can yell at me. Listeners, you're welcome to yell at or whatever you're listening at.
This reminds me of when somebody learns a new word and they're really trying to use it. And they kind of force fit it into a sentence and they have now used it. So they're happy that, I'm sure I've done it myself.
Well, AI can do that.
Exactly.
So yeah. I don't know which it is. I think to me, I just really wanted to comment on, I wonder how effectively companies look at their announcements and can separate ones which matter from ones which don't. And I know I've participated in some where we were just trying to keep some bit of press going about the company. And so you work hard to create some reason, but you're usually not spending whatever it's going to cost for this this effort at Sam's Club, because this is not going to be cheap. We don't know how expensive it is, but it's not going to be cheap.
Looked up in our pre-call that they have around 600 stores in the United States. Mm-hmm. So implementing a program like this with the supply chain and the physical upgrade and modification they need to do and the business process that comes in. So that's not trivial. So I have to assume that whatever helped justify it must have been pretty convincing.
Yeah, they'd have to have something back there. On the other hand, I'm just not seeing it. And I think through my career, although I'm a little faster to say something like that than you are, which I really appreciate in our conversations, but I am much faster to say it. And in my case, I'm just not seeing it. I just don't see how this is going to make a difference in their business. And I've been wrong.
Yeah. So I'm expecting to use the faster as a segue into our next topic.
That's right. Speaking of fast and slow, Shaheen sent me a link to a Daniel Kahneman interview. And if you know, he wrote the book Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right. Mm-hmm.
And he's a behavioral economist is what he's become declared. And, I think listening to the interview, he actually has so many different types of training. I'm not sure why they anchored on behavioral economist, but he certainly has done a lot of behavioral work. And there was a I wasn't thrilled with the interview throughout or his approach throughout. On the other hand, there was a very interesting opening example where he was working in the Israeli military with recruiting and with choosing people to be soldiers. And he was asked to create a questionnaire basically to help interviewers figure out whether somebody should join the army. He created a set of six qualities, I believe it was, and questions about those and said, well, just rate them on these six qualities, and got pushback because everybody's used to using intuition as part of this process. So he, it sounded like somewhat grudgingly said, okay, well, ask him the six questions. And then at the end, write down your intuitive observations out of that. And what he had found before was there was no connection between intuitive observations and the quality of the recruits. Basically, there was no correlation. They weren't connected before. After he did this, they learned a lot through the six questions. But the thing that I found really interesting, and I wish he would have played up a bit more, was after they'd asked him the six questions, their intuition was far better and added significantly to the discussion. Now, I hear a lot of people kind of use that to say, well, see, you can't trust intuition. But I think you and I see it differently. So your thought was really interesting about delaying, right?
Yeah, I thought that the big point was delayed intuition, that you now have more information. Mm-hmm. And if you just reserve judgment until you've got a little bit more data, and that now combined with your intuition can give you a significantly better quality of decision, which is really interesting in my mind.
Mm-hmm. I think it is. That was kind of, I think when you said that, it struck me, it relates to a quote I'll get to in a minute. But I think that was really an interesting and significant thing. And I saw that somewhat in a lot of the focus group research we'd do, because we would watch 30-minute videos with people, and we used questionnaires to gather little bits as we went along, and then we'd talk about it at the end. And the questionnaires didn't matter. What they did is that people processed them differently. So instead of seeing it and in the first 15 seconds going, oh, I hate this, which wouldn't have told us very much about it, the questionnaires gave people a way to kind of hold off on drawing big conclusions until much later. And
I mean, at the end, it's back to the recurring theme that you don't always have all the data that you need to make it black and white, indisputable, academically valid. Mm-hmm. So you have to make a judgment call occasionally. One analogy I saw about Kahneman's Think Fast and Think Slow, and by the way, he won a Nobel Prize in economics in 2020. Yep. So his psychological behavioral studies were of that caliber, and he's really one of the best out there, or was one of the best out there. Mm-hmm. So a good analogy I heard of was in the Econ Talk podcast, and it was an analogy to a camera and how modern cameras have an automatic mode that it just like does a quick job and boom, boom, you're done. And you just take the snapshot. But they also give you the manual controls. So if you're an experienced photographer or if you have a subject that requires it, you could set it up more precisely.
Right.
And the Think Fast and Think Slow was analogous to that. The Think Fast is really good because it does a good enough job for what you need, and many times even a more than a good enough job. But then if you really want to focus, you need to just switch to a different part of your brain.
I think the idea that the quote, and I think it follows up on that, that I really like that goes with this is from David Ogilvy. And the quote is that big ideas come from the unconscious. This is true in art, in science, and in advertising. But your unconscious has to be well informed or your idea will be irrelevant. Let me say that again. Your unconscious has to be well informed or your idea will be irrelevant. So then he recommends stuff your conscious mind with information, then unhook your rational thought process. And I thought that what Kahneman discovered was exactly that, that by doing this interview carefully and slowly, they filled their minds so that their intuition was far better by the time they came back to what do I think I heard. And I think that I think Ogilvy's exactly right. We've got to fill our minds with stuff, and our mind will process them in some unusual ways to discover insights. It reminds me in another book I'm reading, the guy was talking about serendipity, how many brilliant scientific discoveries appear to be serendipity, whatever you want to define that to be. But he noted that it's the best scientists that encounter serendipity most often. And I think it may be that there are minds are the ones that are most filled with all that information, and at least that contributes to it. And I think this need to keep ourselves informed, and then if we keep ourselves informed, intuition, instinct are good tools, just like logic and reason are good tools. And the question is to figure out what tools we need. If we don't have all the data we need, and we never really have all the data, another guy observes that a decision is a prediction of what's going to happen. Because when you decide, the outcome of that decision won't be known until a bunch of things take place. And those are all things in the future. So by deciding, we're predicting what's going to happen in the future. And we cannot ever know that. We will not ever know that. So we're always faced with not having enough data to really be absolutely certain we're making the right decisions. And instinct and intuition seem to have a...
Well, what makes it harder is that because there's such a delay between decision and outcome, by the time the outcome happens, you can attribute it to other things. You can blame other things. And of course, we see that in different walks of life as well.
Yeah.
You kind of make a decision because it suits you. And then when something bad happens 2 years later, especially if you're a politician, you blame five other things rather than your own decision. And then who's to know? And then you move on.
We see company politics all the time.
Yes.
You know, I at some point I wrote a joke, kind of joke about how, you know, CEO hires a consultant and they put in a 2 year effort. And by the time that effort completes, the consultant declares victory. The CEO's moved on to something else. And when the report comes back that says, wow, that was a waste of money, nobody ever is accredited with the fact that it was a really not a good thing to have done.
That's right.
It just gets missed.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it moves on too far.
Okay, let's try to conclude this episode. Any final thoughts?
I'll offer one that we're going to stay away from. I'll just say that in trying to find stories, I got to tell you, the news environment is so noisy with all the upheaval in the world. It gets hard to focus on where are the smart stories for us to cover in marketing because the noise level around us, and I really don't want to talk about tariffs. So, you know, what can I say?
But big picture, because these discussions are so important and mm-hmm. they occupy so much airtime mm-hmm. and therefore time and brain cycles.
Yes.
That's definitely the case. It's just sort of the times we live in.
Yeah, and they are important.
So we wish you certainty and clarity and happiness. Until next time, yeah?
All right, see you.
All right, thank you. Take care, everybody.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.